This is Division 4 of the Colorado Court of Appeals. We're pleased to have with us today senior judge and former member of the Court of Appeals, Leonard Plank. The argument in this case is set for 30 minutes. We have written instructions that both counsel should have received. Have you received them and have you read them? And do you have any questions? Then we're ready to proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Mark Evans, number 40156. I'm a public defender, and I'm here representing Mr. Wesley Stolz. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes this morning for rebuttal.
And if you'll do that with the clock there.
I understand, Judge.
Go ahead.
My argument this morning is that the jury instructions in this case conveyed an incorrect message to the jury about burden of proof. And that message was best captured by the district attorney when he told the jury in closing argument that we don't have to prove it wasn't self-defense in order for you to find him guilty of manslaughter or criminally negligent homicide.
Did the instructions tell the jury that?
The instructions did not say, in so many words, that the prosecution does not bear the burden of proving or disproving self-defense. But the essence of my argument this morning is that read as a whole, that's precisely what the jury instructions said.
But they did not use the instructions that were given to the jury did not use the language that was used in People versus Lara.
That's correct. The language that the prosecution did not have the burden came from the district attorney in closing argument. Before I launch into talking about the jury instructions, I want to talk very briefly about the evidence presented in this case, simply because it's important as to how those instructions were received. Although this is an appeal of a criminally negligent homicide conviction, the evidence presented was focused on first-degree murder. And the state presented evidence not just about the final interaction between Mr. Stolz and Mr. Lusk, but about a whole course of conduct leading up to that. There was testimony about the first attack on Mr. Stolz, testimony about what he said after that attack, and most importantly, testimony about his demeanor at the time that he decided to take the knife when he came back to the scene of that attack. And counsel on both sides acknowledged in closing that one of the most difficult things that the jury was going to have to grapple with was that decision to take the knife. So when the jury received these instructions and sat down and started asking questions like whether or not Mr. Stolz was acting as a reasonable person, it was thinking not just a moment about the moment of the final action, but about the whole series of events leading up to that. So going back to the jury instructions, self-defense was employed here as an element negating defense to criminally negligent homicide, and that means that the state bore the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Stolz was not acting in self-defense. Now, none of the jury instructions expressly require the jury to make that finding, and I don't believe that's disputed by the Attorney General in the answer brief. So the question here is whether that finding was somehow implied or indirectly required by the instructions.
Does self-defense necessarily refer to intentional conduct? I mean, if you're defending yourself, you perceive an attack, you choose to exercise force that you believe necessary and reasonable to fend off the attack, that isn't that intentional conduct?
That's correct. I mean, it applies to the intentional conduct of defending himself, but I don't think that, I know that Mr. Stolz testified that he certainly did not intend to kill anybody that evening, and I don't think that the intent applies to the end result of what happened.
Well, my question is how when you have a conviction here of negligent conduct, how would it be a defense to talk about his intentional use of force? I mean, they're saying here he negligently did this, but your defense, you're saying, is he intentionally did this? He intentionally exercised force that he thought necessary and reasonable to defend himself?
Well, the defense is that the jury should have been able to decide whether he was acting within the scope of a reasonable person when he intentionally defended himself when Mr. Lusk approached for the second time that evening. Now, and part of why I wanted to emphasize from the very beginning that we're talking about a whole course of conduct here is that there's nothing in the jury instructions that tells the jury that it has to simultaneously evaluate criminal negligence and self-defense. And that's why the emphasis that was placed on that decision to take the knife is so important, because on the evidence that was presented and with these instructions, and the jury could have looked at anything along the course of conduct described and decided that that was the deviation from a standard of reasonable care.
I dropped you in the middle of the sentence.
The jury could have said that the act of criminal negligence here, what was outside of what a reasonable person would do, was that act of taking the knife, the decision to bring the knife when he went back to the scene of attack. And nothing in these instructions told the jury that they had to evaluate self-defense at the moment of the final action, at the time when Mr. Lusk was running across the street. And that's when you have to look at self-defense.
Didn't an instruction given by the court tell the jury that in determining whether the defendant acts with criminal negligence, that the jury may consider evidence that the defendant acted in self-defense?
That's correct. That's instruction number 18, and that's the only instruction that was given to the jury that brings together the concepts of criminal negligence and self-defense.
I don't recall you making an argument in your briefs that there had to be an instruction that specified a particular time period during this sequence of events where the jury would have to consider the self-defense and criminal negligence.
Right, and that really just goes to why instruction number 18 that you were just referencing, why that instruction is inadequate. And it's inadequate for two reasons, but the one that is closest to what we're talking about here is that it fails to make the connection between the mens rea required for criminal negligence and the mens rea required to validly act in self-defense. It doesn't explain to the jury that the two are incompatible. Now, the instructions that were modeled in Lahr and in Taylor and tendered instruction number 3 in this case, they all spelled out for the jury the logical friction between acting with criminal negligence and acting in self-defense. But instruction 18 didn't do that. It didn't point out that you can't do both simultaneously. And that's why the trial court erred by using instruction 18 rather than tendered instruction number 3.
Could you explain how it is that you can't do both simultaneously? Would you walk through that?
Absolutely. The walkthrough is exactly the same as what was explained in the Lahr decision, that in order to act in self-defense, you have to...
Let's start. I'm going to ask you to start on criminally negligent homicide, which is what the prosecution had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt.
Right.
So why don't you start there?
Okay. In order to act with criminal negligence, you have to grossly deviate from the standard of care that a reasonable person would follow. Now, it's reasonable to defend oneself from what you reasonably believe is a risk to either your life or serious bodily injury. And that's why, if you're reasonably acting in self-defense, you can't act in a criminally negligent manner. The two are mutually exclusive, just as was the case in Lahr for extreme indifference murder. But that's also pointed out in People v. Roberts, which is a much older case, that does highlight the fact that you can't act simultaneously in self-defense and with criminal negligence. I've touched on one of the reasons why instruction 18 was inadequate, and I want to come back to the other one, and that's that it was phrased permissively. There's a big difference between a judge, someone in a position of clear authority over the jury, telling the jury that they may consider something and telling it that they must consider something. It's the difference between a suggestion and an order. And here, the jury simply didn't have the option to decide that it didn't want to evaluate self-defense. Colorado Supreme Court case People v. Liebarger, although it pertains to affirmative defenses, that's cited in the answer brief at page 17, is clear. The instructions that give the jury the option to decide that a defense is not even an issue are erroneous. And that's because once a defense that the state has to prove has been made an issue, it's not the jury's function to decide whether or not it wants to address that issue. It's the jury's function to evaluate whether the prosecution has proven guilt beyond a reasonable doubt as to that defense. So, and the case is directly addressing element negating defenses. Law and Taylor indicate that the inquiry is mandatory then as well. So the statement in instruction 18 that the jury may consider didn't accurately reflect the law because it gave the jury the option to decide that it didn't have to consider self-defense when it came to criminally negligent homicide.
So you didn't, that the instruction didn't accurately reflect the law? Is that your argument? How do you reconcile that with the provisions or the language of 18.17044 that says the court shall instruct the jury that it may consider the evidence of self-defense in determining whether the defendant acted with in a criminally negligent manner?
It's looking strictly at the statute. It's true that the instructions that were given sound very similar to that, but what you see in all of the cases interpreting that statute, Lara, Taylor, going back to Roberts, is that the point is that regardless of the language used in one specific place, the message needs to get across to the jury that it has to figure this out. It has to evaluate self-defense before they can convict somebody of criminally negligent homicide.
Roberts didn't really interpret that statute, did it?
I believe Roberts, you may be correct, Your Honor, that may have preceded that statute, but Law and Taylor definitely do.
Roberts relied on People versus Fink, and in People versus Fink, without the presence of a statute, the court said that such evidence may be considered by the jury. And then the division in Roberts said that the jury should consider whether defendant reasonably believed, etc. How do you reconcile that holding in Roberts with the case which it relied upon?
Looking strictly at Roberts, it may be difficult, but when you look at Patterson v. New York, the U.S. Supreme Court cases, and all of the cases interpreting the new statute on self-defense, or Lara and Taylor, it becomes clear that this is a mandatory inquiry for the jury. The jury has to decide self-defense one way or another. And I want to direct the court to the prosecutor's closing argument in page 78 of that closing, because the prosecutor gave the jury a model for how to decide this case. The prosecutor said, look at self-defense first. If it was not self-defense, then look at first or second degree murder. If you believe it was self-defense, that we did not prove to your satisfaction that it wasn't self-defense, then look at reckless and criminally negligent homicide. And that model of making this decision removes the burden from the state to disprove self-defense as it pertains to criminally negligent homicide. That impermissibly lowered the burden of proof and requires reversal of this case.
You're saying that the argument lowered the burden of proof and the argument was an inaccurate statement of the law and was misconduct? I'm not sure why you say that. I mean, because you started off talking about the instructions, now you're talking about the argument.
Right. No, this is not a prosecutorial misconduct argument. The prosecutor argued what was made possible for him to argue by the jury instructions. And when the court evaluates the impact of those jury instructions, it looks not just at the instructions themselves, but at the argument of counsel as well in closing. And that's why it's important to evaluate what the DA said to the jury. I'd like to reserve the minute and a half for...
We'll give you an additional 2 minutes because we had so many questions.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Kaler.
May it please the court and counsel, my name is Paul Kaler. I'm a first assistant attorney general in the Department of Law. My registration number is 19210, appearing here for the people. I'd like to say that We appreciate the indulgence of the court in allowing me to appear today, and also the indulgence of Mr. Evans in being very understanding in this situation. I usually try to give brief oral arguments, and this will be brief as well. And I have several points I'd like to make. The Colorado Supreme Court in the 971 Frank Rodriguez death penalty case, the 35C death case, and the U.S. Supreme Court in California versus Boyd talk about when courts review jury instruction issues, that jury instructions are to be read by appellate courts in reasonable means and the reasonable manners that the lay members of juries would read the jury instructions. Both courts caution that courts should not read jury instructions in sort of a hyper-technical, super-close reading that attorneys, especially appellate attorneys, should look at instructions. The question should be, how would a reasonable juror interpret the jury instructions before it, and did it allow the juror to arrive at an appropriate verdict based on the evidence? I think this is probably even more so appropriate in this case, where I believe that plain error is standard review, at least as far as part of the defendant's claim.
As to which part?
I believe concerning the may must language or may shall language in jury instruction 18. Certainly the issue concerning whether defendant should have, whether the trial court should have instructed the jury self-defense is an affirmative defense to the reckless and criminally negligent homicide charges. That certainly preserved. The attack on jury instruction 18, the 18-1704 sub 4 jury instruction, I believe that is not preserved, at least according to my rather brief reading of the brief. Are any other arguments set forth by us is very simple. The defendant, first of all, is wrong that self-defense is a defense to either the reckless manslaughter, which he, of course, was acquitted of, and the criminally negligent homicide charge. It is not a defense. 18-1704 does allow consideration of evidence of self-defense to determine whether the defendant was acting recklessly or with criminal negligence. That was an appropriate instruction of the law, too. Lara has caused some consternation over the past year or so. But here we don't have what I see as the problematical part of Lara, which is the instruction, the direct instruction from the trial court that the prosecution has no burden of proof on the self-defense charges concerning criminally negligence and reckless, which, of course, we don't have here. I don't think there's any burden-shifting problem based on the jury instructions that were given here. So I think that's really all we have to say. Self-defense is not a defense to this charge. The trial court properly instructed on 18-1704 sub 4. And I think that's all that the jury needed in order to fairly decide this case. And we therefore request this court to affirm the judgment of the trial court. Thank you.
Thank you. Bailiff, if you'll, exactly, thank you.
In regard to the preservation of the issues, I think that I've explained what I wanted to explain in the reply brief, but I'd be more than happy to answer any questions from the court. In regard to whether or not self-defense is a defense to criminally negligent homicide, I think that your original question, Your Honor, going through, you know, what's required to convict for criminally negligent homicide and the mental state required to act in self-defense, I think answers that question. And it's true, of course, it's not a statutory affirmative defense, but nonetheless, it's something that the prosecution has to disprove in order to prove one of the elements of criminally negligent homicide. It goes directly to the mens rea.
But if they do prove beyond a reasonable doubt criminal negligence, don't they necessarily disprove self-defense?
Only if they look at it at exactly the same time. And that's why the fact that this was a whole course of conduct, And the district attorney worked awfully hard to prove first-degree murder, to get in everything about the mental state and the deliberation. So the jury was thinking about everything that happened that night. And there was nothing in those instructions that told the jury that they simultaneously had to look at those two things together and that they should realize, based on definitions in two different instructions, neither one of which are the elemental, that the two are fundamentally incompatible. What I really want to grab onto here is that the Attorney General said, read the jury instructions as a layperson would read them. And that's exactly what I hope this court will do. You look at instructions number 13, 14, and 15, and all three of those instructions carry the message that the jury doesn't even need to consider self-defense as it pertains to criminally negligent homicide. The only instruction that brings the two concepts together is instruction 18, and that doesn't spell out that they have to do it, and it doesn't make the connection for the jury that the two are logically incompatible. And the fact that Mr. Stoltz was acquitted of all of the charges where a proper self-defense instruction was given strongly suggests that the jury did not disprove self-defense, or at least raises the question to a point that there's no way that we can be sure beyond a reasonable doubt that they did. And unless the jury made that finding, the burden of proof was impermissibly lowered, and the conviction cannot stand. So I'd respect.
So you're saying the instruction was also given as to reckless manslaughter?
That's correct. The instruction is to wait. Self-defense.
He said he was acquitted. I believe he said he was acquitted to all the charges for which the self-defense instruction was given.
Correct.
And he was acquitted of reckless manslaughter.
Right. The instruction was not given, just to be clear.
As to reckless manslaughter.
As to reckless manslaughter, okay. Right. It's spelled out very clearly that it's a part of the elements of the two murder charges. Yes. If there are no further questions from the court, I'd respectfully ask that Mr. Stoltz's conviction be reversed.
Thank you, counsel. And Mr. Evans, I want to commend you for giving a little bit of room there to the state with regard to some time to get ready for oral argument. That's the kind of professional respect and courtesy we like to see. The court is adjourned.